All right, welcome back to the Iron Curtain, where we bring you a class-conscious analysis of historical and current events which are pertinent to the international working class movement. If you want to help this show grow and expand, you can check out our Patreon account, which is listed in the show description. And if you want to reach out to us, you can hit up our Twitter at Iron Curtain Pod or our subreddit at r/TheIronCurtain. We'd love to chat with you. And we're also available on Spotify and YouTube. Yeah, so today we're going to do another one of our current events episodes. It's that time of the month again. We got, my name is FBK. We're also joined by Comrade Keck, Comrade Denki Kang, and Tactical Spork. How's it going, everybody?
I'm doing great.
Cool. So I know Denki, he's got the first report coming up here. There's been a lot of stuff going on with regards to police violence lately. That's been coming to a head in a lot of different regards. There's, of course, the Ahmaud Arbery situation, which we mentioned in our interview with Caleb Maupin. There was also Breonna Taylor, who was in Louisville, Kentucky. She was shot 9 times. Her boyfriend claimed that there was a no-knock warrant, and so he was expecting that these were intruders, and so he actually fired at them. But now we're hearing of George Floyd's death at the hands of a police officer, and that has sparked a massive protest in Minneapolis. So I know you were wanting to get into this, Denki. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, this is a sad continuation of a common trend that we see here in American society of Black men being killed by law enforcement. And unfortunately, George Floyd is just another statistic, unfortunately, in this whole systemic racism trend that we see among law enforcement. He is very much in the same light as Eric Garner, the young man who was killed in New York selling cigarettes. He was strangled to death by the police. And George Floyd, his final words were, "I cannot breathe." He told law enforcement, "I can't breathe." So he was confronted in a parking lot, and he was apparently intoxicated. And because of this, the law enforcement decided to hold him down to the ground and pinned him to the ground with their knee. And he told the officers repeatedly, "He can't breathe, he can't breathe." And numerous people on the scene started recording and telling the officers to get off of him because obviously he couldn't breathe. And the man tragically lost his life because of this. And this is just a, like I said, it is a sad trend that we continue to see. According to an article from the New York Times, he was ordered to step out of his car. This was a statement from the department. After he got out, he physically resisted officers. Officers were able to get the suspect into handcuffs and noted he appeared to be suffering medical distress. That's, that's a very squeaky clean way to put it. But on the screen share, I will actually show some footage here. So this is the video footage showing the arrest of Floyd George. That was a brief footage of the aftermath. We saw him on a stretcher being taken to an ambulance right there. This is the man himself. This is Floyd George. He was a high school athlete. He was well beloved in his community. I think he was from Houston. And he will certainly be missed by his family. And one thing that has happened as a direct result of this murder are widespread protests throughout Minneapolis, which have been disrupted by police through the use of tear gas, a very violent response. But obviously, there are hundreds of protesters here. This is especially worth noting that this is during the time of coronavirus. A lot of people aren't really encouraged to get out and congregate, but yet these people, they're all wearing masks, they're all you know, it looks like they're trying their best to maintain social distance, you know, while they're being tear gassed by police. But they have come out in mass protesting, demanding justice for the murder of another black man by law enforcement. And I was speaking to a friend earlier about this. She was actually in a protest where they used tear gas. And they said that tear gas is excruciatingly painful. It not only is very painful to breathe it in, but the way that it seeps into your skin and it burns. It is a very inhumane riot control tactic. And I think it should only be used in the most extreme circumstances. And here you see these people exercising their First Amendment right, trying to protest against police brutality against yet another black man, and they are tear gassed by the police. So I'll open the floor to everybody else. What does everybody else here think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's absolutely incredible in a just disgusting way how just a few days ago you had armed white people essentially storming into their town halls in places in protests so that they could get a haircut and things like that against the COVID-19 quarantine. It just shows like those people were not perceived to be a threat. You know, they never got fired at, they never got tear gassed, they never got their necks stomped on for literally storming into a government building with AR-15s and AK-47s and you know, assault weapons, because they're white. You know, like, this country will treat you with kitty gloves if you're white, no matter what you do. But if you're a little bit intoxicated, if you just show any sort of resistance, or if you show absolutely no resistance at all for even the most minor things, the police essentially will crack down on you if you're a member of any sort of marginalized or minority group. I mean, the thing with I Can't Breathe really reminds me of another case with Eric Garner. I'm not sure if you guys remember him. He was killed on July 17th, 2014 in right. New York. He was, I guess, selling like loose cigarettes.
Right.
Like individual cigarettes, I guess, which is, I mean, it's like, it must be like a very, very minor misdemeanor or something like that. But just for doing that, a cop just grabbed him by the neck and just would not let him go. And he kept saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And he died from that for the most minor possible offense that you could possibly have committed, you know. But because he was black, he was essentially just treated like, you know, just like garbage that you can just throw away whenever you want. You know, cops essentially have that ability. They can just take a life at a whim and essentially get away with it. And sometimes they won't even get a slap on the wrist.
Yeah. And the whole, you know, I can't breathe slogan, of course, it came out of that case. And it's so interesting to see it come up again and be very applicable, you know, 6 years later. And I just think it's very interesting how it does seem like these things do come in waves. You know, it just has that effect of really rallying people up. You know, it's just been one after another. And that's what, I mean, really set off these protests in Minneapolis. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, they probably would have protested this nonetheless, but the fact that these keep just stacking on each other and everybody's seeing it happen one after another, you know, these cities, that kind of tends to be the point where they actually rise up. That's how it actually kind of happened here in Memphis when I believe it was 2017 or so, they closed down the bridge, but it was just like it was like a good bunt there where there was just police killing after police killing. And there wasn't even one here, but it just like had that mobilizing effect. So I really wonder how that's going to go, because, you know, we're already seeing it here in Memphis. There's already people protesting here after this recent event that happened in Minneapolis. So, yeah, I'm really curious to see where it goes. And of course, how they're going to treat these police officers, because, I mean, there is a lot more of a public eye on these kind of events. And, you know, there was that case in Chicago with the police officer, Jason Van Dyke, and he was actually sentenced to 6 years in jail. So yeah, I mean, we might be able to see something like that happen again, but it will be very interesting to see what happens though.
Personally,
relation to the Minneapolis murder, just recently a police officer in the same jurisdiction killed a white woman for reasons that didn't warrant it. I can't remember if it was like they were raiding a brown house or something, but a police officer killed a white woman and they received 15 years. And it's going to be interesting because people are using that as a metric for what should happen for this incident. And another thing I wanted to make a comment about tear gas is something that not many people know about tear gas is that tear gas under the, I think it's the Geneva Convention, constitutes as a biological weapon, or a chemical weapon, excuse me, not biological. So in international war, tear gas is illegal. However, using tear gas against your own population, since it's an international war, it's perfectly legal, as well as a lot of other crowd-controlling techniques.
Now, Assad, President Assad in Syria, he used chemical weapons on his own people, folks. We gotta go invade.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty wild how those two things just kind of work out.
Yeah, and talking about George Floyd, I'm also reminded of the Trayvon Martin incident, where that young man, he was in the wrong neighborhood, apparently. All he did was go to the supermarket to buy some Arizona iced tea and some Skittles, and his neighbor George Zimmerman decided to play cowboy and shoot him dead. And by many, he was heralded as a hero who stood his ground. And it just shows that in American society, Black people are not safe. You're not safe when you're out jogging, as in the case of Ahmaud Arbery. You're not safe when you're just sitting on your car, like George Floyd. You're not safe when you're going buying some Arizona iced tea and some Skittles, like Trayvon Martin. I mean, and even if you're not doing anything wrong, all it takes is some, you know, douchebag with a bug up their butt to call the cops on you, and now they are rolling the dice with your life. If you're a Black person, every single encounter you have with a law enforcement officer could potentially be the end of your life. So, you know, it's just such a dangerous and hostile environment. We can talk about how law enforcement disproportionately targets African Americans. We can talk about how the private prison industry profits off of the mass incarceration of African Americans. We can talk about how, in many ways, that is a new form of slavery here, when private prison labor is being contracted out and businesses are using it to fight fires or to build roads. There are so many facets of American society which have been affected by this systemic racism and directly profit from it. And it ultimately goes back to, people ask, why are the police so brutal in American society? And it's because the police are the servants of the bourgeois. They don't serve you and me. They don't protect and serve us, the people. They protect and serve the interest of the bourgeois. And right now, what the capitalists want more than anything is a giant labor force that they can essentially tap into endlessly. And the war on drugs provides them that. This systemic racism, this crackdown on the Black community, it provides them that. And we've seen how the U.S. government tries to intervene and how they respond when the Black community begins to rise up, like the Black Panthers, they panic. So any comments about that?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Capitalism always has a vested interest in having like an underclass of society of some kind that it essentially deems like essentially just below the rest of society that it can super exploit and essentially crack down on whenever it needs to in order to secure this hyper exploitation. You know, we have immigrants to do work for less than minimum wage, but also the Black community in the United States is essentially almost functioning as a sort of semi-colonized, I would say, labor pool that the U.S. government has a vested interest in it not doing well and not succeeding. They're routinely denied opportunities because essentially our country, well, capitalism essentially needs a reserve pool of labor that it can just kind of extract mass profits from and treat terribly.
Yeah, I mean, let's put it like this. Black people and white people use drugs at a relatively equal rate. There are studies out there, sociological studies that have shown this, but Black people are much more likely to get arrested. So let's say that you're a young Black man arrested for smoking a joint. Well, now all of a sudden you have a felony record. You're in prison. You've got a record now. So like here in the state of Tennessee, you can no longer vote. So you are now politically disenfranchised as a Black man, and your children are raised in an environment where a father's absent. Study after study shows that an environment where a father's absent leads more closely to a life of crime. So this whole thing feeds into itself. Generation after generation of political disenfranchisement of Black people. And it is a very crafty way for the bourgeois to control the Black community, to keep them out of the voting booth.
It reminds me of something I saw on Twitter where I think the FBI, when the Black Panthers were essentially doing one of their free breakfast for school kids programs that they had, the FBI, whoever the head of the FBI was, I think it was J. Edgar Hoover, declared that program to be one of the greatest threats to the United States' national security in like his memory. Which just goes to show any sort of program that sort of fosters independence, fosters community solidarity among the Black community, fosters, you know, positive feedback loops, is an immense threat to the system that we have going on right now.
Yeah. And speaking of feedback loops, you know, Danke, he was kind of describing like a more negative feedback loop, how this influences each other and these things just keep perpetuating itself. And, you know, it is interesting because, you know, it's like, if these people are so concerned about problems in the Black community, if they're really so concerned about crime, like I'm talking about like conservatives, like they want law and order and all this stuff. Well, I mean, if you were really to go at the heart of it and tackle those issues, you would have to change society in like a radical way. And that's why they won't break that cycle and why it just keeps perpetuating itself. There's a really good book that I've been reading. It was called, It's called like How Race is Made in America. And it talks a lot about how in the 30s, the big question was like Mexican immigrant labor. And there was a section of the bourgeoisie who was like, we really want to exploit these people because, you know, we can just pay them a few bucks and it's awesome. But then there's sections of the bourgeoisie are like, well, what about our like white supremacist state that we want and everything? So they very much come into like collision with each other, but that's why these things won't really be resolved under capitalism. They've found a way to just kind of keep it going and not really address the issue directly.
Well, the main reason it's not going to be solved under capitalism is just to some degree it's profitable. And some degree, it's tactical. Like, there's definitely profit that is created from racism. There are just the feelings of racism, or even vague dog whistles alluding to racism. But what I really wanted to talk about that was some of the things that Donkey had first mentioned. First off, like the Black Panthers arming themselves, and it's taking I think it was a county capital, united the KKK, the NRA, and Ronald Reagan to pass the first gun reform law, the first modern gun reform laws in America, basically prohibiting the sale to, I think it was felons, but it was basically so black people would have it more difficult. A lot of their clauses in the law basically made it more difficult for black people to get firearms. And another thing I want to talk, two other things, but first, the people always talk about the systemic racism in policing, but the historical origins of police have deep-seated racist roots, because the police forces were formed from slave catchers, or not all of them, but some police forces were formed from former slave catchers. And then lastly, the history of oppression associated with the war on drugs, both domestically and internationally, especially in the global South, has had far outstanding consequences. I don't understand. This leads me a little off topic, but a lot of people complain about the immigration issue of people from South America immigrating to America. But it seems totally hypocritical to me with all the destruction we have caused in South America, specifically due to the war on drugs and financing coup d'etats in various countries. So we're directly responsible for this surge of immigration.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you guys have any other comments, or would you want to move on?
I thought those were really good points. But yeah, I think we can move on here. Let's see. So yeah, I'm going to be discussing some new developments in the subject of arms control. So we know that Trump has pulled the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Now, last week, the president has taken aim at the Open Skies Treaty. So according to the Armed Controls Association, the Open Skies Treaty permits each state party to conduct short-notice, unarmed reconnaissance flights over the other's entire territories to collect data on military forces and activities. So Mike Pompeo has claimed, well, let me explain what this is real quick. Basically, it's a way to allow each state to have mutual agreed upon spying on each other. So Russia can say, hey, we want to check out like your military installations to see if you're, you know, mobilizing. And as long as they give them like a moment's notice and it gets cleared, like they can send an unmanned drone in. And this is a way to just prevent that kind of mobilization from happening. I mean, these countries are going to spy on each other anyway, so it's a good way to like make it just agreed upon. But Mike Pompeo, he's claimed that Russia is taking advantage of this agreement by using its technology to select possible targets. Yeah, he thinks that they're literally just trying to scope out places in the United States where they can possibly attack us one day by doing these unmanned flights. And Trump, he said on May 21st that the U.S. would not be renewing the treaty in February of 2021, effectively setting an expiration date for the Open Skies Agreement. Let's see. So this cutting off of decades-old armed treaties has unfortunately become a reoccurring theme in the Trump administration. But the situation took an even more sinister turn as we learned on Friday of May 22nd that the Trump administration officials were discussing the possibility of testing a live nuclear weapon for the first time in 28 years. This possibility was discussed on May 15th in a meeting of top national security agency officials who were responding to accusations that China and Russia are testing low-yield nuclear weapons, which is something that remains to be unverified. They're basically saying that they are testing nuclear bombs underground, small ones. And this is something you can do, but like they said, there's no evidence of this. And here's the thing, even if Russia and China were conducting low yield nuclear tests, the testing of a nuclear weapon is not only a troubling precedent to start, but it's also totally unnecessary. A moratorium on nuclear testing, which was established in the 1990s, it makes it so the U.S. must limit its tests to what is called subcritical tests. By testing the components of the weapons without producing a nuclear chain reaction has been the safest way of doing this. This is just basically a way where you can test all the components of the weapon without actually having to explode one. So this has just been the norm, essentially. So to suggest otherwise, to suggest that we need to test a live one and do it the old-fashioned way, that's just essentially posturing. You know, that's just essentially trying to, I mean, that we know that that's what a lot of these nuclear tests were back in the day, and that's just simply what they're going for now. But, you know, this is just kind of more evidence that for some, you know, who think that we're moving towards a possible Cold War type situation. And it's interesting because, let's see, there is Marshall Billingsley. He is the special presidential envoy for arms control. And he said during a Houston Institute webcast that, quote, "We know how to win these races, and we know how to spin the adversary into oblivion. If we have to, we will, but we sure would like to avoid it." So that's very interesting, the way he said that we've done it before, and, you know, we know how to do this, because that's essentially what the arms race was against the USSR. It was a way to make them militarize so much of their economy that they could develop, but it definitely hindered them. So this is kind of like an old tactic that they are willing to bust out again, because they see, you know, it came out today that, it was a European official. I'm going to have to remember his name, but he said that Europe's getting to a point where they need to decide if they're going to go with the United States or China. And a lot of countries are starting to feel this way. And it's just, you know, this is a way for the United States to essentially, they've actually said their plan. They want to test this weapon live so they can make a more agreeable term on future arms control negotiations. So, like I said, this is pretty much just a strong arm to the Chinese and the Russian right now. But yeah, I'm curious what everybody thought about that right there.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say this sounded exactly like the sort of neocon Reagan type strategy where essentially you try to intimidate your opponent into thinking that you have something, some sort of incredibly advanced technology that can break the kind of mutually assured destruction strategy and force your enemy into kind of taking the bait, spending huge amounts of resources into trying to compete with you on a military scale. But honestly, the fact that the US is deciding to kind of start nuclear testing again, I don't think that other countries necessarily need to be super concerned or start massively improving their nuclear stockpiles or anything like that. I mean, what is it essentially telling us that Trump is testing nuclear weapons underground, that the United States has nuclear weapons? I mean, we've known that this whole time. It's not anything particularly new. So, I mean, I think the same strategic setup is still in place. I mean, it's not like a Star Wars type scenario that could completely throw off. I mean, that's essentially what happened in the 80s. Gorbachev was afraid that Reagan's Star Wars program would protect the United States from nuclear war and then would give them a free hand to attack the Soviet Union. But I mean, that ultimately turned out to be essentially a massive bluff that cost the USSR quite a lot. But yeah, I mean, nothing in this really indicates that there's any real substantial change in the technology. I mean, it's really awful for the environment to be doing actual nuclear testing. It's, you know, I'm sure it's very detrimental to public health and all that, and it definitely raises tensions, but I don't see this as necessarily changing anything substantial.
I agree. Yeah, and that's why I said posturing, because you're right. It's like, yeah, we know this is there, but that's essentially what it is. But yeah, I saw you were trying to get in there, Comrade Keck.
In my opinion, I think the posturing is more telling than the actual detonation. As I mentioned in another podcast, I think this goes to show how old NATO alliances are deteriorating, especially between North America and Europe. So these it just shows that these imperialist powers are trusting each other less and less, and are going for, since it's interesting to even consider that this is a new development, and if it may be a new development in imperialism, because beforehand, during the USSR reign, they essentially had all the imperialists were united, had a common enemy, but now it seems as though that they're splintering.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you just look at the EU, has been several times in danger of coming apart at the seams from a series of economic crises with Greece, with Italy, with the UK leaving and Brexit. I mean, the idea that Europe is essentially just a united, perfectly happy place where all these countries are working together mutually. I mean, I think the coronavirus has really exposed that for what it is. I mean, all these countries that were talking about the greatness of united Europe and Western civilization all working together just completely fell apart with these countries essentially swiping each other's medical supplies, all looking out for each other's all essentially looking at each other with suspicion, and the US essentially pirating medical supplies from these countries and not providing any aid whatsoever. Whereas, you know, places like China and Cuba, especially Cuba, has been sending doctors all over, especially to Italy. China has been sending medical supplies to Italy, and it's massively increased the public's positive feelings towards these countries, whereas the US is essentially seen as the sick man of the Western world or something like that. I've been seeing a lot of that online, just the US essentially just being dead in the water and incapable of handling any of these crises. So I think a lot of these countries are essentially trying to look out for their own interests now, because they see that NATO is incapable of really standing firm and protecting their mutual interests.
Yeah, and that's, you know, after the two world wars, that was the creation of like the League of Nations and the UN and all that. That was, you know, ways to keep these imperialist powers from fighting all the time, essentially. But we're just at an interesting point now where these countries, I mean, they are down to cooperate for the most part, but it's like they may see it as a little old fashioned, this whole, like, you know, USA being the big boss or whatever. We see them kind of like laugh at Trump behind his back sometimes. I mean, some of this stuff, I mean, you know, it's like, okay, but you do see it on a more important scale with things like the question of Huawei phones, and are we going to let our country use that or not? And some countries have taken the position of like, well, I mean, this is like a free market, right? Why are we not going to give our citizens the best phones? And if China's selling the best phones, why would we deprive our free market of that? So there's almost like an argument you can make about that in that way. So it's just becoming maybe a little silly to some of these countries. I mean, I'm sure they understand why the United States is doing this. I mean, of course they understand why, but we're getting at a point where it may not be in their best interest to stay with them. But, you know, to go over and, you know, for the Europe to just shift to the side of China, I mean, that would be a big event. I'm not saying that that's just going to happen sometime soon, but it's just kind of like a little fissure that's kind of tending to grow right now that we're seeing a little bit. So I think that's kind of where it's at.
Yeah, capitalist countries naturally tend towards a state of competition with each other. And the Cold War was an exception to that rule, where they were united against, you know, the socialist bloc temporarily. But as Lenin kind of told us, you know, countries is eventually, if they don't have any common interest to work towards, they will eventually start to compete with each other and see each other as essentially prey to be gobbled up, in the possessions of those countries as like kind of spoils to be stolen. So I think that sort of tendency towards interstate competition really is kind of showing its head now, that they don't have any clear targeted enemy.
Yeah, that was what I was trying to get at, essentially, that it's just inherent in imperialism to, after essentially accumulating or conquesting the other smaller businesses within your that you're competing with, to then start targeting other industries and whatnot, other just all in the name of consolidating capital.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I know you have a there's been a lot going on with China right now. I know that Tactical Spork, you were planning on presenting something on Hong Kong. Once again, I see that there's major protests going on there, and as I'm aware, there is some type of, I'm bleeding into this bad. Let me just cut it off to you there. What would you like to, talk about in Hong Kong?
Sure. So recently there's been quite a lot of controversy and talking about events going on in Hong Kong. As we kind of know, the protests that had been kind of racking the city for several months did kind of settle down due to the coronavirus for a little while. But this is obviously only really a temporary thing. But just kind of, if you haven't been kind of keeping up with events in Hong Kong ever since a few months ago, essentially protests got kicked off there a couple months back due to an extradition treaty where essentially I believe a Hong Kong citizen killed his pregnant girlfriend in China on the Chinese mainland, but then fled to Hong Kong. And then the Chinese government tried to extradite him to be tried in China because he committed the crime there. But essentially they couldn't do that because the two places did not have an extradition treaty with each other. Even though Hong Kong is a part of China, it has separate sets of rules and is given certain privileges and autonomy. I shouldn't say privileges necessarily, but autonomy that other areas within China do not have. So essentially the ex-colonial government of Hong Kong and the people there bristled under this, what they saw to be an imposition over their autonomy, and started to protest saying, oh, well, if they can extradite this, you know, pregnant woman killer, they'll be able to extradite all the dissenters and all the people who don't approve of China. And so it kicked off this whole thing. But what's actually interesting is a Forbes article recently got released that said, I believe, only about 12 to 17% of Hong Kong citizens that they interviewed, that they consulted for this poll, actually wanted to be independent from China, only 17%. And then I think only about something like 22% were even against the Chinese government in the first place. So actually the majority of Hong Kong citizens are not against the Chinese government, and they actually tend towards the side, the majority of citizens actually tend more towards the side of the Chinese government and against the protesters. Because I mean, how, a lot of people who might be listening to this might be like, oh, how could that possibly be? I mean, these Hong Kong protesters, they're fighting for democracy and freedom, and why wouldn't everybody be on side of their rights? Well, I mean, for the one thing, there's just the practical matter of these protesters have essentially destroyed the entire city's economy, and have been incredibly disruptive. They're blocking traffic. They are putting down road spikes on the roads to destroy people's tires. They're burning out buildings. And I mean, of course, you could say, oh, well, all protests are disruptive. You can't really, you know, criticize them for being disruptive. But I mean, these are not just peaceful protesters by any means. I mean, people have been criticizing the Hong Kong police department for brutality, but they have not killed anybody up to this point. Zero people. And supposedly these are the most brutal, you know, communist crackdown. In the United States, in the past week or two, how many people have been killed by police officers in times of peace with no essentially major protests, anything equivalent to the Hong Kong protests going on? You have essentially just a permanent level of brutality and crackdown on African-American communities, minority communities, essentially people just being killed all the time. Meanwhile, the Hong Kong Police Department has essentially not killed anybody. And the actually only people who have been killed during these protests have actually been killed by the protesters themselves. An elderly man who was sweeping the street was hit in the head with a brick by a protester and killed instantly. He was just an ordinary man just doing his job, going about his business and trying to undo a slight amount of the just blind destruction these protesters have unleashed against the city. And he was killed for it. Another person was lit on fire for essentially arguing in favor of the Chinese government. Protesters, including a woman, was recently backed up against the wall by a huge crowd of protesters and beaten severely because she spoke in favor of the Chinese government, or at least against the protesters, which is, I mean, pretty obvious. I mean, if it's very easy to disregard all of the damage that these protesters are doing when you're living on the other side of the world and not having to deal with this every single day. But if you're just an ordinary person in Hong Kong just trying to go about your business, this is an incredibly disruptive thing, and it's very understandable that people are getting fed up with it. So essentially that brings us up to now, where the Chinese government has recently issued a new set of rules, essentially giving them more leeway in cracking down on terrorist activities and foreign subversion within Hong Kong. And so a lot of people listening to this might possibly be like, oh, well, they're just going to use this as a pretext to arrest innocent protesters or crack down on dissent in the first place, peaceful dissent. Well, the protests in Hong Kong are really far beyond anything resembling a domestic peaceful protest. They've actually discovered pipe bombs inside of university campuses created by these protesters. The protesters have essentially been throwing Molotov cocktails and bricks. They've been creating essentially just terrorist weapons and plotting terrorist activities against civilian populations. They've been planting these bombs on college campuses and in crowded areas of the city. Not only that, this is not something that is purely orchestrated by the people of Hong Kong. There is an extremely high degree of foreign interference, namely by the United States government, within the Hong Kong protests that are essentially creating a grassroots, astroturfed campaign, giving it the appearance of a grassroots movement that has the majority of support of Hong Kong people. So actually the leaders of the Hong Kong protests were spotted consulting with the United States Department of Defense, or the State Department, and United States ambassadors, essentially working with them and consulting with them. They've received significant amounts of funding from overseas through government NGOs backed by the United States. And this is all very well documented. And so one of the major parts of this bill that China is trying to implement is cutting down on foreign government interference and foreign government funding of these groups, which is actually one of the major parts of it. But it should also be noted that what they are planning on doing in Hong Kong is not anywhere near out of the ordinary for the rules that apply to the majority of the Chinese mainland. They're not putting in any particularly brutal or particularly harsh lockdown procedures or any kind of particularly harsh things that are exceptional to the Chinese mainland. They're essentially putting slightly more control over the Hong Kong situation, but this is not exceptional to what the rest of the Chinese mainland has to do. So they're putting it one step more towards essentially acclimating it to the rest of the Chinese mainland. So that's my little bit of report on Hong Kong. I was wondering what you guys have to say about that.
Yeah, I sort of wanted to open this up to everybody here, but why do you guys think that so many Western leftists support these Hong Kong protests? I mean, I think I have sort of a theory, And I think for a lot of people, they want to oppose authority. They want to oppose this evil totalitarian country that they've been told, you know, is just really stamping down on the people's freedom. And, you know, keeping it real, a lot of American anarchists out here have a hatred for the police. And I totally understand that. But they generalize that hatred to mean all police forces, all forms of authority, including, you know, proletarian, you know, power, including proletarian state authority. And so when they see this, you know, quote unquote authoritarian government stamping down on people's freedom, they hear that buzzword freedom, I feel like a lot of them just buy into this whole Hong Kong protest cause hook, line, and sinker without really a second thought. And I think it because a lot of them carry these sort of Western biases, like, you know, just this instant attraction to that buzzword freedom that you hear about. And freedom and democracy, when used by the Western media, really just means opening up your country to Western capitalists.
Yeah, I think it's very telling the fact that Western leftists will idealize and essentially idolize the state of Hong Kong before it was returned to China, which is very, very telling for a number of reasons. But I think primarily it's the idea, this Orientalist sort of notion that the West, when it the UK with its liberal democracy, it brought its liberal values of freedom and democracy to Hong Kong. And during its occupation of Hong Kong, it was just this pearl of the Orient. It was this wonderful beacon of Western civilization amid a sea of, you know, Asiatic barbarism and savagery. But the people of Hong Kong enjoyed, you know, perfect free speech and, you know, their rights were protected. They had democracy. But now China is coming in and stealing all of those rights because they don't care. They're just a, or they're just a hive mind, right? But this is absolutely the furthest possible thing from the truth. And when I see this from people in the West, people in America, especially leftists on the West, they're really betraying their own ignorance of history and ignorance of politics, and also just Orientalist and chauvinist attitudes and imperialist attitudes that still seep into them, even though they may consider themselves to be on the left. So what was China, what was Hong Kong like when it was under British imperial rule? Well, it was essentially ceded to the British monarchy during the Opium Wars, in which essentially China tried to prevent the flow of opium into its borders by the British Empire, which was profiting massively from essentially getting the entire Chinese population addicted to a crippling drug that just destroyed their labor force and destroyed their people's livelihood. So the Chinese emperor tried to cut down on that, but the British essentially declared war on it, on them, because it was such an important source of revenue for them. And the British, with their superior navy at the time, managed to beat back China, and Hong Kong was given to them as a concession. But this was essentially during this 125 years of British rule, it was essentially run as an apartheid state in which the Chinese people living in Hong Kong had essentially no democratic rights whatsoever. They could not vote. They were treated as second-class citizens, and the British citizens living within Hong Kong were essentially above the law. They could do essentially whatever they wanted, and they would be tried in a British embassy, essentially. So they were essentially not bound to the rules that they set out for the Chinese people living within Hong Kong. And it was actually only just a couple of years before Hong Kong was handed over. I think it was 2 or 3 years before Hong Kong was handed over back to China that the British government essentially gave them a semblance of democratic rights in Hong Kong, essentially just to essentially pass it back to China and say, oh, we made it democratic, so now, you know, you're taking away our perfect democratic rule from the city. Well, I mean, essentially China restored democracy to Hong Kong because the British had absolutely no intention of giving the Chinese people of that country, of that city, any sort of rights whatsoever until they realized that they had to, the jig was up and they had to hand it back. I mean, Hong Kong is essentially a capitalist wasteland. It is one of the most quote unquote free markets in the entire world. And it has one of the highest rates of income inequality of any place on earth. And the vast majority of working people of Hong Kong live in essentially tiny boxes. They're so crammed in and they have absolutely no labor rights whatsoever. They don't have the right to organize. They don't have the right to protest against their employers. There's essentially no labor regulations whatsoever, so they can be hyper exploited. Any leftist that is even remotely opposed to capitalism should not be in favor of Hong Kong, because their autonomy that they've been given by the Chinese government, which is essentially allowing them to have the same rules apply as they had under British colonialism. I mean, Hong Kong is essentially run by a small group of well-connected families and well-connected corporations. Those are the people who are actually running the entire show. So the idea that Hong Kong is just this beacon of liberal values and freedom, and China is allowing them to have this freedom. I mean, freedom for who? Freedom for like the five families that own all of the stuff in Hong Kong. Meanwhile, the rest of the workers just don't have anything. And I mean, obviously the Hong Kong protesters come from different areas of Hong Kong, but I mean, Hong Kong's educational system all throughout British rule was essentially brainwashing them to see Chinese mainlanders as barbaric, as stupid, as uncivilized. It was essentially giving them an indoctrination of British imperialism. So a lot of these people living in Hong Kong have essentially been raised to see themselves as superior, as see themselves as like more well-bred, more almost even racially superior to the people of China, which is absolutely disgusting. I mean, I saw recently there was a test that was meant to be given to Hong Kong school children. I think it was like, you know, elementary school, middle school children, that was talking about, do you believe that the Japanese invasion of China did more harm than good? Like, as if that was a contestable thing. Like, oh, you know, maybe Japanese occupation of China with the Nanking massacre and, you know, millions of Chinese people being bayoneted for, you know, or shot for target practice and, you know, raped and massacred. Oh, maybe Japanese imperialism did have some benefits. Maybe they restored some civilization to these, you know, disgusting barbarian people. So, I mean, the attitudes of the Hong Kong protesters are nothing but absolutely right-wing, hyper-capitalist, and backed by U.S. imperialist interests. So I think these protests are really essentially the ultimate neoliberal protest to back from the perspective of people in the United States. Like, it's essentially a safe protest to back if you're in the United States, because it's against evil communism as opposed to any sort of real meaningful third world struggle. But it also distracts from actual real struggles that are going on in Latin America and the Middle East against Western imperialism and US backed governments. So I think it's really just very telling when people back these things, having done no research whatsoever into the conditions of China, the conditions of Hong Kong, or any of their history. It's just intellectually dishonest, and it just shows the level of Western chauvinism that really just reeks into every area of our society.
There's two things I want to say. First, that not a lot of people know that Hong Kong had recently entered into a similar agreement that started off the whole thing with the United States for extradition rights of certain individuals. But the one of the less spoke about provisions of extraditing Hong Kong people in Hong Kong is that there's a lot of Chinese who commit serious financial crimes in China that then the CCP attempts to prosecute those crimes and they flee to Hong Kong for refuge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
they use Hong Kong as a sort of base or a base of operations to engage in other illicit and seedy intellectual or financial dealings throughout China, since they have that immunity.
Yeah, and like we mentioned a little bit earlier, the hypocrisy is just astounding when you look at these like protests that happen here versus what's going on in Hong Kong. I mean, I feel like this is so obvious, but the fact that so many people are actually defending Hong Kong protesters shows that a lot of people don't understand this. But I mean, if we were doing things like the Hong Kong protesters, like shining laser pointers into police stations and stuff like this, I mean, that would probably just set it off right there. But I'm not trying to defend like the police, like they're like, oh, they're the best over there. But for the most part, I mean, they seem pretty chill if they're going to like sit there and take that kind of abuse for so long. And I mean, it's pretty wild. I mean, of course, there was the man who was caught on fire by one of these protesters. There was somebody who was literally thrown off of a building and got serious injuries. I mean, if this was going on here, we would see major serious crackdowns. And I'm still surprised that, you know, China didn't have some type of extradition law before all of this. And, you know, they were even willing to say, hey, well, if you guys are going to protest like that, we're just going to take that law away. And that wasn't enough. You know, they were like, well, we still need our democracy, like our abstract vision of democracy, while holding like a British and American flag. So, I mean, what can you really do with that if you're the Chinese government? You can't really concede on that front, but they were willing to work with them for the most part. And, you know, that was just kind of thrown away, but it's very much just how these things are pitched to us. I mean, as to the question of why leftists here in America support the Hong Kong protesters, it's just the way it's sold to us. I mean, there was, you know, massive protests in Chile last year. They were protesting against parts of the constitution that went back to Pinochet's government. And, you know, that didn't get nearly as much play in Western media as Hong Kong protests do. And it's obvious to maybe us why that is, but for a lot of people, they just can't see through that. And that's just the biggest hurdle, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, if you want a real protest to back, you should be backing protests in Bolivia against the coup regime, the right-wing coup regime that has been cracking down on indigenous people. You should be backing them. You should be backing protests in Iraq against U.S. military bases. You should be backing protests in Colombia against U.S. occupation there. You should be backing protests all around the world against actual capitalism and actual imperialism. You shouldn't just be protesting whoever the United States corporate media tells you is the protest of choice for the week, because that's not a critical analysis. It's completely devoid of historical content, and it's, you know, actually supporting those protests will actually go towards making a better world and decolonizing the world. Supporting Hong Kong is not going to be doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we've been talking about China a lot, but I mean, hey, they've been in the news so much. I mean, they are getting attention on a lot of different fronts, to say the very least. And just to mention it in passing here, I know a lot of people may have seen that there is a situation going on between China and India. They're engaged in a border standoff in the area that is called Ladakh. China has sent about 800 to 1,000 troops in the region. Now, India, they're claiming that these Chinese troops are in their territory, but it's just hard to say. This whole area, Ladakh, if you look it up on a map, if you do the reading on it, you see that they haven't decided on the exact definitions of who owns what in this area. Pakistan is also involved. They have a little bit of claim to this, but there was actually a border war over this in 1962, and that lasted like for a month. And after a while, they pretty much came to the agreement, okay, we don't know who owns what in this little place called Ladakh, but we're going to just kind of set that to the side and mess with that in the future. But we're just going to leave it alone for now and just, yeah, set it there. But you know, recently there was a situation in 2017 where the troops were actually fist fighting each other. And that happened again earlier in the month, where troops between the Indian forces and the PLA, they were fist fighting again. And, you know, that led to this situation where, yeah, China is mobilizing some troops there. This is still very early on. What's going on here? We don't really have any definite conclusions to take out of this as of yet, but it is interesting because, I mean, look at all the fronts that China is being attacked on or being criticized on. And it is just like kind of like a full court press kind of situation against them. So yeah, I just thought I would mention that in passing here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I haven't looked into that to an insane degree, but it does seem essentially like it's more of a kind of saber rattling type of thing. I don't think anyone really has any huge interests in that area. I mean, it is a holdover from previous conflicts, but I really would not expect anything to really boil over there.
Yeah, I would like to reiterate that too. You know, if you look at the satellite images that have been released, you see that there's some like temporary camps that China has set up in the area. But I mean, there's a lot of questions here. I know that India, they have been kind of mobilizing the region a little bit and building some permanent structures in the general area. And that has kind of led China to, you know, be a little suspicious. So, yeah, I mean, some people, I don't think it's at a point where they are going to jump into armed open conflict or anything. And I was just looking at it. And if you look at the size of like China's military versus India and everything, I mean, they just don't want that. Both sides don't. So it is just kind of an interesting thing that is ongoing, but we'll definitely have to see where it goes.
Cool. So I think we had a comment from our previous video that we wanted to address. Do you have that on hand?
I do. So let's see, on our last video, it was, we read an interview between H.G. Wells and Comrade Stalin. And on our YouTube comment, let's see, somebody from our audience named Gordozin, they asked us, thoughts on President Xi saying that China won't come back to a planned economy, choosing instead dirgism, which is essentially a, forcing the market in certain areas, but it's not quite a planned economy. And let's see, we had the quote from President Xi pulled up here. Does somebody want to read this quote? This is from actually Bloomberg, and this is what President Xi said.
Yeah, I'll read it. I can't pull it up, but we could do that in post. But yeah, I'll go ahead and read it like now. So it says, "We've come to the understanding that we should not ignore the blindness of the market, nor should we return to the old path of a planned economy," Xi told political advisors gathered in Beijing for their annual legislative sessions on Saturday. According to the official Xinhua news agency, he reiterated the government's stance that markets should play a decisive role in the economy.
Yeah, so this is very interesting coming from President Xi. We've spoke a little bit before on, you know, how we viewed China, but yeah, I'm curious what y'all think about this. What do you think? Why do you think President Xi is pointing this out at this time?
Sure. So, I mean, I could take a little stab at it. So I think one of the issues of this was the original source of this article that most people were sharing around came from Bloomberg news website, which obviously is not it's obviously not like a pro-China or pro-leftist publication whatsoever, but I think just a lot of people tended to read the headline and kind of accept the premise of what it was implying without actually digging really into depth with it. So there's actually quite a few better news takes on this than the Bloomberg article, but obviously the Bloomberg article was the one that had the attention grabbing headline, so it was the one that got shared around as sort of a dunk on China and a dunk on tankies that defend China, etc., etc. So what is he actually addressing with this quote? This is essentially in the context of he was giving a speech talking about the impact of the coronavirus on the Chinese economy and their plans for the rest of the year, because obviously China sets out five-year plans and they set certain demands for the Chinese economy, like, or set certain goals for the Chinese economy that it wants to reach at the end of a certain year. And 2020 is the end of their current five-year plan, when they're going to start a new one in 2021. So essentially what he was talking about was essentially the disruptions that came about due to coronavirus. And he was basically saying, well, the coronavirus really threw a wrench in a lot of our plans. And so a lot of our preset goals that we had set at the beginning of 2015, when they set about making these plans, we're going to essentially make these goals non-binding for 2020. So it'll be cool if you guys can reach it, but we're not going to like really impose them on you, because we understand that a lot of these goals can't be reached now because we had to shut down so much of our economy in order to effectively quarantine. So that's sort of the general context of what he's talking about. When he's talking about this here, he's essentially, a lot of it depends on the translation, but Bloomberg kind of made it imply that this is something that, like, a planned economy, like 100% planned economy, is something that China will absolutely never refer to or never pursue in the entire future. They're always going to be exactly as they are now. But this isn't really the case at all. President Xi was really talking about their goals for the immediate future. And he was saying, like, as a result of this coronavirus epidemic, we're not going to expand our market sector and like completely open ourselves up to the blindness of the free market, but we're also not going to take emergency measures and go back towards the planned economy style of the 60s and 70s, which is what most Chinese people would be thinking of when they were thinking of a fully planned economy, even though under Mao the economy was never fully centralized. It was considerably more centralized during the time period, but it was never 100% fully fully centralized and fully state run. They always had a small petty bourgeois sector of the economy that they had to make concessions to, but it was never fully planned. But essentially he was just saying the market sector, essentially what he's saying here is not any sort of departure from any of the current plans that China has already been pursuing. This really doesn't change anything about what they're saying. Essentially what he's saying is, we're going to continue on with our current model of development that is working extremely well and has provided a lot of benefits for us going forward. And obviously, we're going to take a dialectical and material and pragmatic approach going forward. If things are not working, we're going to make tweaks and adjustments and everything like that. But we're not going to be making any radical changes, either for more market reforms or towards more centralized planning reforms as a result of this crisis that we're going to be dealing with. But the plans are essentially, the plans are still holding as they currently go. But a lot of people took this as, oh, we're not going to move towards socialism. Everything is going to always stay the same forever. And China is just capitalist revisionist rotors who don't care about their people. People essentially took what they wanted to hear from the headline and ran with it.
Yeah, I'm glad you did a little bit of extra research as far as like the context of that, because I just read the Bloomberg article. That was about it. But I mean, if you take it at face value, you know, it seems like it could be kind of clear, like he's saying, you know, nor should we return to the path of the old planned economy. He doesn't say ever. And like you said, translation is a very important thing. We know that New York Times, they mistranslate these people all the time, especially like China. And I personally want to like look into that, like the context a little more, because that is interesting, because he very much could be talking like in the short term. Because look, even if like President Xi doesn't think that they're going to become like a planned economy in his lifetime, it does seem kind of odd if a socialist was saying, I never think we're going to advance towards a planned economy. Like, you know, because, you know, there's types that believe it might come like 100 or 200 years from now. So right. To say it's never is odd. So that's why I am a little suspect if he meant that. So Yeah, the context may be important, like you
it's
said.
It's also not up to him. He's not like right. the emperor of China, where everything that he says is immediately made into law. Essentially, the direction of China is going to be determined by a mixture of the factors, you know, other events that come forward in the future, but also the will of the Chinese people. The Chinese people ultimately do have a democratic system where they can, you know, elect representatives, and those representatives represent them and vote on current issues. There's plenty of divisions within the Chinese Communist Party that all have very different ideas of where they want to take the country, but it's not up to Xi Jinping alone to decide what happens in the future, and not in the next 5 years, 10 years, not in the long term as well. I mean, their plans change according to what the people's demands are and what the situation is at the time. And I mean, also, it's not like Xi Jinping was like, if he was going to announce that they were never going to continue to pursue socialism or anything, he wouldn't be doing it in this like kind of offhand way in the middle of a speech that is talking about something else entirely. This would absolutely not be the place to break big news at all. Like, I think it's essentially they're taking one sentence that he said about it in a speech that was about something completely different that could be interpreted in a certain way, and they ran with it. So, I mean, if he was going to announce any sort of big changes in plans, he wouldn't be doing it like this.
Oh, sorry. I was trying to unmute myself. I tend to agree. I think, you know, something like that. I mean, one could be, you know, sneaking and things like that. But, you know, we just don't really know, you know, that's the thing. And most importantly, even if Xi Jinping did mean this in like if you're just taking a face value reading of it and that's all, the important thing to keep in mind is, yeah, it's not up to him. I know that he starts off the comment here with the term we, so he's kind of speaking on part of the whole Communist Party, but you know, as conditions change, even if they did decide this now, I mean, you know, that doesn't mean that the party can radically change or whatever, but yeah, personally, I think I would like to learn a little more about exactly what the context was. You said that he was speaking at what type of event, didn't you say?
It was the National Congress, the meeting of the 19th meeting of the National Congress. So essentially just kind of summarizing events of the previous few months since the last Congress and kind of deciding what measures should be taken going forward, considering the circumstances.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. We addressed that question there. We got about like 7 minutes left or so here. I was just going to throw out one last little thing here. Now, I know some of you may have been following this hydroxychloroquine situation. It's been interesting because I kind of like got into it right when they were like studying this stuff, because I was just kind of like interested in the idea that people were taking it and dying from it. Have you guys heard of this yet? People were taking it on their own and they've been dying.
Oh yes, it's amazing. It's the best cure. It's the cure, ladies and gentlemen. It's the best. My friend, the doctor, the greatest surgeon of all time, he told me.
Yeah, and it's heralded, of course, in that fashion as like the. You know, he can't even be nuanced. He can't even say, well, it could be promising. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. And sure enough, I believe it was March. There was a couple in Arizona, and they found that they had some hydroxychloroquine in their house. And it is regularly used to clean fish tanks. And they had the bright idea of drinking this. And sure enough, they were sent to the hospital. And unfortunately, the husband, he did die. The wife, she survived. And when they asked her, they said, what the hell were you thinking? Or something like that. And she goes, well, I heard Trump talking about it on TV, and we thought it would be a great way to protect ourselves from the coronavirus. And she even goes on to say, they asked her, they're like, if you could put one piece of advice out there for everybody, what would you say? And she said, oh my God, don't believe what President Trump says, or something like that. But it's a horrifying story. but I was blown away when it happened again, and it happened again in Nigeria. Look, I mean, the president of the United States, people are going to listen to him all around the world and at least see his opinion. And sure enough, in Nigeria, there was actually 4 people that were hospitalized from taking hydroxychloroquine on their own. This was maybe about like a month ago. And one of those people did die. And this was just one of those situations where, people were just kind of self-medicating with this stuff. And I'll just finish with this right here. It is unfortunate too, because these sites that sell hydroxychloroquine, you can either buy it as a medicine or to like clean fish tanks. Well, the place that sells it for fish tank cleaning, they're totally sold out. And that's kind of implying that somebody out there is stocking up on this for the intent of using it medically. And even the medical supply, that's diminishing, even though, you know, the CDC has said that they're not going to do any more testing on it. The World Health Organization said the same thing. And sure enough, they decided that it actually causes major heart issues with you. But as we all know, Trump, he has been taking it. I think he said that he would stop taking it. That might have been today or yesterday. But I just thought this was wild that there is actually people out there who have died from something the president has said people should take. I mean, let's be honest, you can take like a flu shot or something like that, but something like a coronavirus, you can't really prevent it against it unless you have antibodies. So that's just very silly to think that this chlorine type substance will protect you from it. But that's apparently some people believe the president on it. So it's amazing to me.
So they think that this hydroxychloroquine, if I'm getting that right, they think that it will actually give you immunity to the coronavirus. Like it contains coronavirus antibodies and stuff.
They don't say that it has the antibodies, but they just think that it will somehow protect them against it, which no study that was even done on this stuff was implying that. This is just something right. that like is just kind of a theory people have made.
Like from my meager understanding, this is a novel virus. So anything short of a vaccine won't really protect you against it. I mean, you can take measures like wear a mask, avoid public areas and stuff. But, as far as like drinking fish cleaner, you know, I just don't see that as a viable way to treat this thing. Even if it treated symptoms, it's not going to like, you can't like douse yourself in this stuff and then go to Walmart without a mask on and like kiss everybody that you come across and not catch the virus.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And, you know, they have actually been saying that people have people who use this, I guess they use it for lupus and some other disease medically. Well, those people have been having trouble getting it because there's just so much people buying it. So I'm just kind of blown away that we know the president has a lot of influence, and we know that this is a very volatile time, and people are hinging on a lot of his words. So, it's just kind of an amazing phenomenon to see play out here in real time. But, it seems like that might be it for today. Did anybody want to get in any last pieces of news or anything like that before we head out of here?
Keep up the good fight, everybody.
Yeah, honestly. I mean, I hope everybody out there is doing well, hanging in there. I know it's tough to stay under the quarantine measures, but really do take it seriously. I mean, listen to medical experts, listen to, just listen to people who study this kind of stuff from a scientific perspective. And just stay safe and take care of the people who are in your life, because, you know, they deserve it. And everybody deserves to be taken care of.
Absolutely.
Stay safe, everyone. Have a good night.
Absolutely. Well, that's it for our current events episode. This is the Iron Curtain. We're out. Thank you.
All right. Solidarity, everybody.
I love you.